Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, manufacturing businesses face a race against time to close the equity gap. A new law upholds companies liable for corruption by third parties. Hidden curriculum flaws fuel South Africa's reading crisis. And small-scale miners in focus today as the draft minerals law lands. It's Friday, the 8th of August. Now, it is being called the biggest compliance scramble in South African HR history, with just 3 weeks to go before the 31 August deadline. Designated employers must submit revised employment equity plans under the new Employment Equity Amendment Act, or face stiff penalties. In manufacturing alone, and listen to this number, nearly 70,000 black managers need to be appointed by 2030 to meet gazetted targets. Obviously, the question is this achievable, or are we heading for something of a policy train wreck in the making? Labor law expert Jonathan Goldberg is with me. Jonathan, welcome. Let's start with that hard number, 70,000 appointments across manufacturing management levels. Do you think this goal is grounded in reality or aspirational without any practical legs?
Well, I think it is aspirational. I think the problem is how did we set these targets? I think that's the problem the market is really sitting with, is did we look at the skills? Did we look at realistic targets over 5 years? There's no debating that progress in respect of employment equity on the designated groups been too slow. But I think then if you set triple or tenfold the targets, then I think people then give up before they start. And remember, this 70,000 is across junior management to top management. That's what the gap seems to be on the latest reports collected by the Department of Employment and Labour. So it is a tall challenge. For me, it's how the department implements these targets that is going to be critical as to whether they are targets, aspirational, or quotas.
The regulations, Jonathan, come with serious penalties, I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong, but up to 10% of turnover and exclusion from state contracts. Is there a risk that we're maybe creating a compliance culture of fear and not necessarily transformation?
I think, you know, if you look at the 18 sectors, I think the real question is how many of those sectors have agreed on these targets? That's a real measure for me. In business and government interactions, you want to try and get as much agreement and consensus. That's why you want national dialogue as possible. And if you're not getting that, then you need to come back to the table and say there's something wrong. So here, I think only two sectors have partially agreed to these sectoral targets, definitely not more than two or three out of 18. That means there's something wrong with the consultation process. And that's clearly what's taken up in the challenges that have been taken to the courts in respect of this process. One of the challenges around there hasn't been sufficient consultation with realities and looking at the realities that are prevalent in these various sectors. Of course, some of the challenges are that 18 sectors are too small. They should be having sub-sectors and many other sectors. But the simple litmus test is between government and business, you want as much consensus as possible. There isn't consensus here. Maybe the time is to relook at these, do another round, proper consultation to try get 10, 12, 15 sectors agreeing to aspirational targets. That would be a measure of success.
You're obviously closer to this issue than most. In your own consultations, what has the private sector's general response been so far? Is there a degree of engagement? Is there some resistance or maybe even confusion or maybe a combination of all three?
I think we've got to go back to the Act. I think the Act's always had a fine of 2% for the of your turnover, potentially for a fine if you don't comply with the current Act. and it's always been there, as well as the government contracts have been there, but the government contracts issue has not been implemented in the 1st of January legislation that was enacted. So it's been around, but not in put into law. It's now been put into law. I think if we're really open about this debate, the Department of Employment and Labour has been quite kind in respect of the implementation of the current act. So I don't know anyone who's been fined 2% of the turnover. I know fines of in the couple of R100,000 where people just haven't complied at all. So the department up to now has been very easy in the implementation, going alongside businesses, working with them to a large extent. Not in all cases. There have been some reports of unreasonable inspectors. If they do the same with the current aspirational targets, in some sectors clearly unrealistic, then there's no problem. But again, people are worried that they don't get their compliance certificate. If you don't get your compliance certificate, then you are excluded from government contracts for a year. I think that's the issue.
You know, it's all well and good if there is a degree of latitude, but it's also about the optics. And I would imagine that many businesses might be warning that targets are simply unattainable because they just can't find the right people. And maybe there's a sense of the legislation setting companies up to fail. Am I pushing that a little bit too far, do you think?
I think there's an element of that, and clearly some clients are seeing it that way. And that's where you need to convert the clients to say, listen here, you are short, for instance, of African males and females at top senior and middle management, as an example. Then we've got to go out our ways, and it's always been like that. The Act's always said that, to try and recruit African males and females in those categories. So long as we are trying, let's assume we can't find them because it's the engineering sector, we need qualified female African engineers, we can't find them. As long as you keep the records of that, that is what's expected. But for me to go recruit Jeremy because I've known him for many years, we played rugby and at university, that's the problem. So again, it's the recording and the process that you need to follow. I think if organizations do that and they take the spirit of the law and the fact that we need more people to participate in the mainstream economy, no problems with that at all. And I think you'll not have a compliance problem even if you don't meet the target. So many, many companies, vast majority, are not going to meet these hypothetically manufacturing targets for top senior, middle and junior management. But as long as they got the record keeping and effectively can then prove that, there will never be a compliance issue, in my humble opinion.
Jonathan, record keeping aside, and I understand that there are some legal challenges already in motion, how should, in your opinion, employers then be walking the line between meeting the deadline and also be preparing for potential reversal?
I think no matter what the reversals would be in the court cases, I think the initial act is not being challenged. So the actual premise of the act, that you still got to comply or face a fine potentially of 2% of your turnover, I think that's still there. So I think you should ignore the executable targets for the meanwhile and do what you need to do in terms of the law. And the law says you must do an analysis of the national or regional demographics, decide where you're underrepresented, and then target those particular people that are suitably qualified in those positions. I think that's always been the case, and that would be my advice. Just focus on what the law says, do what you need to do. Again, Jeremy, the truth be told, is the market's also changed. The people that are buying your products, your services have also changed, and you need to ensure that you represent the new market.
Just a final one. Are you worried about unintended consequences? In other words, risking job loss or even investment pullback if the targets outpace the available talent?
I think the tariff issue now has moved the cheese. I think we need to really get around the table as business, labor, government, civil society and say, okay, what are we going to do differently going forward? And definitely going differently, to, for my mind going forward, is trying to get more consensus. So if there's so much objection in so many sectors to things, then we need to get around the table and sort out those objections, because we are not going to win this race unless we change things, and we need to change them now. We've got another COVID moment now, in my particular opinion, with the tariffs.
Jonathan Goldberg, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A major legal shift has just raised the stakes for South African companies in the ongoing fight against corruption. New changes to the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act now make companies liable if someone linked to them, in other words, an associated person, commits bribery. Now, that could include include, I understand, employees, agents, contractors, or even service providers. The law puts the onus on firms to prevent bribery or face prosecution. So it seems to me as if this is a big and important change. What does this mean, though, in practice? I'm in conversation now with Professor Rihanna Kasim from the University of South Africa. So, Professor, thank you very much indeed. Maybe the key phrase here is associated person. What exactly does the term cover and why has that been introduced?
Thank you so much for having me. You're quite right. This is a major shift in our law. So an associated person is anyone associated with the company who performs services for the company. So even could even be any professional person who performs any services for the company. So in addition to the persons you mentioned, employees, suppliers, consultants, and so on. And they introduced it to make sure that the company now has a duty to take proactive steps to actually prevent bribery by the persons associated with them. So that is the thinking behind it.
When you talk about proactive steps, it surely, though, is going to put a lot more pressure on compliance and legal teams.
Yes, most definitely. So what the term used is adequate procedures. So as you mentioned, if a person associated with the company commits bribery, the company could be prosecuted for this criminal offense unless it can show that it already had adequate procedures in place, which means companies should actually start now to put certain procedures in place because it's the only defense that they will have if a person associated with them commits bribery. But it certainly does put a lot of compliance responsibilities on company to now implement these procedures.
Principally, then, what kind of procedures need to be put in place immediately?
Well, we actually don't have any guidance issued by the government. So this law came in April last year, but since then, the government has not issued any regulations saying what would constitute adequate procedures. But South Africa borrowed this law from the UK, and they implemented it in 2010. So what we can do in the meantime is look at the UK procedures to see what they regarded as adequate. I can mention a few. So one thing they say is that companies should adopt procedures that are proportionate to the bribery risk they face and the nature, scale, and complexity of their activities. So a larger company operating in a high-risk market where bribery is known to be common would have to do more to prevent bribery than a smaller company in a low-risk market where bribery is less common. Other things companies could do is that the board should foster a culture where bribery is never acceptable and there's zero tolerance for it. And companies should also carry out due diligence procedures on the associated persons to make sure that they are trustworthy and communicate their policies internally and externally so everyone knows what their stance is on their anti-bribery policies and even provide training to the associated persons and their employees so everyone is aware of that.
Difficult, of course, to develop a bribery risk framework, isn't it?
Yes, it is, especially since you're never really going to know if what you are doing is actually adequate without any black and white guidelines. So you may think it's adequate, but if something does happen, a court may say, no, this was actually not good enough.
Which tells me that many companies, in the absence of those guidelines, are simply navigating blind at the moment, which is very unsatisfactory.
Yes, correct. And I don't think that many companies have actually even started implementing guidelines because they don't have guidance on how to do it. So it seems that this law came in a year ago, but it's an excellent law, in my opinion, to try to stop bribery in South Africa. But I don't think it's actually being implemented. And I think the government needs to start putting a bit more focus on it.
What's your advice to companies right now, Professor, who haven't yet updated their policies right now? What do they need to do in the here and now?
So I think to start off with that they should at least draft policies to say what their stance is on anti-bribery and make the associated persons aware of this. I also think that they should evaluate their relationships with the persons associated with them to make sure that they are trustworthy. And I also think that the board should foster a culture where bribery is never acceptable. So it cannot ever be said that the board did not make this position clear to people associated with them.
I understand what you're saying, but it all seems fairly opaque at the moment. Would that be enough to comply with an existing law?
I don't know. So we haven't had any cases in court yet, and no one's actually been prosecuted for this. I mean, just take the IDT case, which is in the media at the moment. You know, that is a prime example where the IDT can actually be prosecuted for not preventing their CEO from committing bribery. So yes, I think it is opaque, but I think if a case does come before court at a time when we don't yet have guidelines, I think a company would then be able to say, well, they didn't have guidelines and they did what they thought was good.
So it's going to be difficult as well in the absence of those guidelines for prosecutors to prove that a company failed to prevent bribery. So it's a problem on both sides of the legal coin.
Yes, but I think at the same time, if an associated person did commit bribery and a company did absolutely nothing, there's no indication that they implemented any procedures at all to prevent bribery by the associated person, then I think there is no defense, because it is an offense of strict liability, meaning the company can be held criminally liable even if they had no mens rea, even if they didn't know about it and they had no idea about it. So if no procedures are taken, then the company would be held liable if someone associated with them commits bribery.
Professor Riana Kasim, thank you very much indeed from the University of South Africa. I appreciate your time.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now let's move on to this, and South Africa's reading crisis, I think, is back in sharp focus. But one key factor often gets overlooked, and that's curriculum policy. Now there's new research by Rhodes University's Dr. Tracy Kitchen that finds that while learners may score well on reading tasks, they're mostly being asked shallow, literal questions. The deeper skill of reading for meaning is getting lost in translation from policy to classroom. I'm in conversation now with Tracy Kitchen. Maybe Tracy, and welcome, a good starting point here is a definition of reading for meaning. I think we know what it means, but just give us your understanding.
To give you a little bit of context about reading for meaning, this is really where our learners are able to understand what they're reading. So generally at the grade four level, learners can decode words. So they can understand the word, they can see that C-A-T, cat is cat, but they might not be able to understand that in the context that they're reading within. And this has really become a big problem in South Africa. I'm sure that many of your listeners will have heard the research that we have 81% of learners who cannot read for meaning in South Africa at the moment. And really, this means that they're not able to identify explicit information, or they can't make straightforward inferences as well.
So Tracy, is the problem teaching, or is the problem, as you might suggest, also policy?
I think that there are a lot of contributing factors. We can't generalize and say that it's a determining factor. There are many things that contribute to this. Before I talk a little bit about my research, I just want to mention that it is a single case study. So this was research that was done in one classroom. And so the results are not necessarily generalizable, but I do think that there are important implications that come from it. In my study, I found that there was really a melting pot of contributing factors. So it was conducted during COVID-19. So that was a huge factor. There was a lot of pressure on teachers. The education system also bears the weight of the apartheid education. Curriculum itself has undergone a lot of revisions since apartheid, and this doesn't really provide much support for teachers. But in addition, and I think to answer your question more clearly, is that the curriculum policy, so CAPS, there are gaps between what it suggests for assessment and how it relates to classroom practice. So there is a gap between the policy and the practice that I found in my study.
Do you think teachers are under-trained, are they under-supported, or simply overwhelmed?
I think it's a combination. They really are very overwhelmed with demands from the Department of Education, in terms of what the curriculum needs from them. And I think that we do need a lot more support for our teachers. So I think it's a combination of all of those things.
Why should we be worried about a finding like this? Because obviously it would contribute to South Africa's poor global reading scores. But that, if you continue to link the dots, is going to have a long-term impact on the economy of this country and our growth.
Absolutely. It also has a lasting impact for your higher education. If our learners are being tested on very literal levels, so at the lowest cognitive level that they can be, there's no space for critical engagement. There's no space for the kind of appreciation and evaluation questions that they need to be asked and working towards. So it could have, you know, major implications for business, for the economy, for higher education.
Am I also hearing you correctly when you say that while teachers are in many respects overwhelmed and under-supported, there's also a problem perhaps with the materials that are provided to support the curriculum, as well as the textbooks themselves, and maybe the way in which they're written and designed?
Yes, absolutely. So I can tell you a little bit about that. In the curriculum policy, in the CAPS documents for the intermediate phase, so this is grade 4 to 6, the assessment guidelines are very clear, and they state that there should be a kind of a balanced distribution of the kinds of levels of thinking and understanding that, you know, the learners should achieve. And this is based on Barrett's taxonomy of reading comprehension, which itself is based on Bloom's taxonomy. I'm sure that, you know, the teachers that are listening will be very familiar with that. And these levels show that you can read at a very literal level, or you can become increasingly more complex to include things like inferential meaning and evaluation and appreciation. And in CAPS, it states very specifically that there should be a balance of these questions. So 40% should be literal, so lower order cognitive skills. 40% should be inferentials, and 20% should be evaluation and appreciation. What I've found in my research is that the textbook that was being used, now this was specifically indicated that it was a CAPS-aligned textbook, the questions were not representative of that distribution. So in fact, the text that we looked at relied very heavily on the skills, your literal skills. So the split was actually 73% literal, 20% inferential, and only 7% higher order thinking. So the problem is that the textbooks are not necessarily representative of the, you know, the kind of balance of distribution that CAPS is requiring. So our textbooks are, well, the textbook that I looked at anyway was not representative of that at all.
So just a final one, if you had one urgent message or a piece of advice for education policymakers, what would it be?
It would be to make sure that they align the policy with the materials and the resources that they're using, but also to make sure that they equip the teachers that are using these materials to understand them better, to understand what these cognitive levels are and how they can be implemented and how they should teach towards them. We really need to do this from the ground up.
Dr. Tracy Kitchen from Rhodes University, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's move on to this, and South Africa's Draft Mineral Resources Development Amendment Bill for 2025 is being touted as a turning point, but it's also raising fresh concern. Among its key changes, a formal licensing regime for artisanal and small-scale mining. Advocates say it offers a path to inclusion and job creation, but critics are saying the devil is in the detail, isn't it always? Well, joining me now is David van Wyk, who's lead researcher at the Benchmarks Foundation. I want to examine what the bill really promises and what might go wrong. David, a very warm welcome. So the new bill proposes formal artisanal zones, as I understand it, and streamlined permits. So I guess my first question, do you see this as genuine reform or simply papering over cracks?
Well, I think that as civil society, we've been meeting about the amendments to the bill for the last 3 months, and we will be making some submissions on the 13th of August, which is the deadline for the bill. We are not entirely happy that it actually deals with the issues properly. One of the reasons is that South Africans have historically, that is in terms of colonialism and apartheid, been excluded from mining because there was a division of labor where frontline states or labor sending areas provided the labor for mines and South Africans were working on farms. So the knowledge of mining among South Africans is fairly limited, and this reflects in the conflict between artisanal miners and South Africans on the ground, where people living in near mine communities as South Africans provided domestic worker labor, gardening services and other things, but were excluded from the mines themselves. And so unless the bill begins to address a way of getting South Africans to collaborate with people who do know about mining, the people who keep on coming back from Mozambique, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, and of course the Eastern Cape, the one part of South Africa that was not excluded from mining or from migrant labor, we are not going to go very far. We're just going to see conflict because the migrants will be the ones who will be making money while there's massive unemployment in the rest of the community. This then creates a situation of envy and conflict because locals will say these people are taking our opportunities. But, you know, if you don't know how to mine because you've been excluded from it historically, you're not going to be very good underground.
Do you have any suggestion then as to how to bring those two parties closer together? And as you've already said, often they are working in complete conflict with each other and there is a lack of trust.
Well, yes, this is where we have now really poisoned the water over the last couple of years because of the xenophobic kind of politics that people have been playing in order to try and get votes, which is a very dangerous game to play, given that our country's wealth was built on migrant labor coming to work on our mines and so on. And many people have family members from labor-sending areas and so on, you know, across border and so on. The borders, the colonial borders, didn't make sense in the first instance. We really need to begin to rebuild the relationship between the majority of people in South Africa and their neighbors. And it was quite a good relationship in the 1980s because the struggle and people were coming from these countries through the liberation movements and so on. And it was quite good in the 1990s when SADC even wanted to have an open border policy where people from these countries do not require all the necessary documentation and so on to be able to freely move. But that whole initiative by SADC has simply disappeared. I don't even know if SADC exists anymore. It is dead quiet at the moment.
All of this, of course, is predicated on bringing those parties together, as you've said. Whose job is it then to start the rebuilding process? And is there appetite, is there will within the Department of Minerals and Energy to actually do that? I would imagine the starting point would be with that department.
Well, I think that the Department of Home Affairs, we need to actually work out ways of people crossing borders without it turning into conflict. We also need to work out ways of service provision and so on so that it becomes inclusive. You know, the hatred for the other has reached a point where in the Northwest Province, for example, even at clinics, nurses are turning away not only foreigners but also people from the Eastern Cape. They are saying people from the Eastern Cape are not quite South African, simply because they used to work on the mines. You know, when we work in the platinum fields, we often come across people complaining that because they Xhosa speaking, they are excluded from clinics. You know, this thing can easily become tribalistic and it can become even more problematic than what it is at the moment. The government needs to work with civil society. It needs to work with human rights groups. It needs to work with anyone who has a footprint in communities to overcome this gap. And also it involves planning for a post-mining society where we scale down large-scale mining because it is disappearing in front of our eyes. It's evaporating. BHP Billiton has left. Anglo Gold Ashanti has left. Anglo Platinum is in the process of leaving. Anglo Coal has left. We really have to plan for a transition, and we're not planning for a transition. And people talk about a just transition in energy. We should actually talk about a just transition in mining and plan for that. You know, the thing is that what I can't understand about politics in South Africa is we always allow a crisis to develop before we intervene.
David, let me bring you back to the actual bill itself. And there's that old cliche, isn't there, that you can't manage a problem unless you can measure it. And you've called for a central buying agency and, more importantly, better data. I don't think the bill commits enough to gathering accurate production figures. What is your view on that?
Well, I think that the bill needs to actually cover a full audit of the mining industry in this country so that we can determine at what state mines are, you know, because a mine has a life, you know, and it's like a human being. It's very troublesome in the startup phase, and it's very troublesome in the closure phase. You know, it's like a baby and an old person. We really need to find out where our state of mining is, and be honest about it. You know, the Minister of Mining creates the impression that mining can go on forever, but it's not sustainable. You know, we must stop still talking about sustainable mining because minerals are not renewable. So as we move to that phase of mine closure, large-scale mining is no longer profitable in this country in gold. It's very rapid profitable in platinum, in coal because of the global movement towards electric vehicles and so on, and also alternative power generation. It's becoming unpopular and so on. We have to admit these trends. And once we admit these trends, we can then establish where are we at with the different minerals and how should we manage each. At the moment, chrome is simply being plundered in the northwest, Mpumalanga and in Limpopo. And those are not Zamazamas. Those are people with trucks and graders and things like that. You can't call them Zamazamas. You can't call them artisanal miners. They are simply crooks who are taking the chrome across the border into Mozambique. So we also have to understand that the whole problem of illegal mining in this country is not summarized by the word Zamazama. It has different aspects to it, different realities to it that we actually need to analyze in terms of each mineral and then respond to the challenges that it poses with regard to that mineral. The problem also is that we want to run a free market in this country when in actual fact we should be doing more planning, and we're not doing any planning at all. And we're learning nothing from BRICS. The successful economies in BRICS are the ones who plan. We look at China, we look at India and so on. You know, in India, they've got certain minerals that they don't export at all. They put a ban on them because they consider those minerals very important for India's industrialization. The same with China. You know, why is it that we are members of SADC, we are members of BRICS and so on, but we actually do not contribute anything meaningful?
Thank you very much indeed for a very forthright interpretation there. David van Wyk, lead researcher at the Benchmarks Foundation, thank you very much for talking to me. And that is where we're going to leave it for this Friday. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.